I'm Steve Martin. This is Unreal Bluegrass. Thanks again for tuning in. You've walked into the second hour, if you haven't been listening, of what can only be called Bela Fleck Day. I've been really sampling all of Bela's work. We'll continue to do so as we progress through the program. There's so much to choose from. It's not like, can I get enough? It's like, how do I make it 3 hours and not 45 hours? So I've been giving you samples of it all day. I'm going to talk to Bela in just a few minutes about several things he's got going on, the release of Rhapsody in Bluegrass, the As We Speak album, which won at least one Grammy, maybe two for the single release from it, and his upcoming album, Remembrance, which will come out in May of 2024, which is Chick Corea and Bela Fleck, a collection of tunes that I think you could fairly say that Bela has curated, and sort of a last devotion to his friend and co-composer, and they had such a great time performing together. You'll hear about some of that, but Remembrance, we're going to talk about that. We're going to sample from that, too, by the end of the program. So let's begin this portion with Rhapsody in Blue, parenthetically Grass, from the Rhapsody in Blue album, and then we'll get right into our new discussion with Bela Fleck. I do enjoy speaking to him. We had a lot to cover, and we did it. Thank you so much for tuning in to Unreal Bluegrass. The audience of Unreal Bluegrass just heard a tune that you've heard frequently on Unreal Bluegrass. It's the Rhapsody in Bluegrass. It's from Bela Fleck's 2024 album, which is a phenomenal album. And I happen to have Bela Fleck on the phone right now. And Bela, thanks so much for finding time to join me. I know you have a murderous schedule of touring and recording. It just never stops. So welcome again.
Well, thank you. And I try not to think of it as murderous, but generous or fortunate that I am to get to do all this stuff and stuff that I dreamed of doing, and somehow my life has transformed into reality of some hopes that I had when I was a lot younger. But it is a lot of work, and it's also the hardest part is doing the family in tandem with it. So sometimes one or the other suffers, and it's always disappointing when it's the family. And it's, of course, it's disappointing if I have a hard time getting prepared for something really difficult, because life is, you know, the family takes precedence.
Always.
But it's all again very, very fortunate. These are first world problems.
Well, you're right on that. That's absolutely right. Your tour schedule, which everybody can find if they just Google Bela Fleck, they'll find it, and they'll see what I meant by saying murderers. It's just a constant. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I don't know how it could be in a good way, but I mean, it's just
well, it's so funny because I look at it and I go, you know, I'm not doing that much. That's how I feel. But because there's like whole months now that I'm not going anywhere, or I go out for just a weekend, surrounded by, you know, and again, with kids, you try not to be gone for more than a fortnight at a time, but sometimes you just have to. Like when we went to Europe, you can't go over there and not to go longer, because it just costs so much to get there and to pay everybody. It's a good life. It's good. I'm not complaining.
So, in addition to the dates, and people will look at the tour schedule and they figure this out for themselves, you'll do dates of different types of music. Like one on top of another, and I always think, how do you make that switch in gears? Of course, you do it, and you can sit down. And on top of that, I would say that if somebody wants to experience as much of that combined effort on, I think on May 4th of 2024, you're going to be at Carnegie Hall, and you have a show that's called Rhythm, Raga, and Rhapsody. And I think you're combining a little bit of everything that you're maybe doing currently. Is that a safe statement?
Kind of. I mean, there's a lot that's there. Yeah, absolutely. Carnegie Hall is always a big deal. I've gotten to be there a few times now, and it's always for some reason you get. It's funny, you could play to the same number of people in Topeka, and it wouldn't make you nervous. But in New York City, at Carnegie Hall, it does. So it always seems like a lot of effort and worry, and you know, to do something really special happens whenever I play there. But so this one is, I'm going to be playing some duos with Zakir Hussain, so that touches on the As We Speak record that just won the Grammys.
Won a
goodness.
Couple of Grammys. How about that? I didn't know that category existed. That was great.
Yeah, I know. That was really a sweet surprise to get when I was out in Europe with the Bluegrass guys, with Sierra and Michael and Brian and everybody. But, so we'll have Zakir and I doing some duets. I'm going to do some duos with Bruce Hornsby, who I've always loved, and we've been good friends for a long time. Like, again, another amazing thing that fell in unexpectedly. And then I'm going to play the Rhapsody with the orchestra the original Rhapsody in Blue arrangement, except with me playing the piano part, like on the record. And then we're going to do Rhapsody. Then we're going to do the Bluegrass Heart Band, and I'm sure we'll play the Rhapsody in Bluegrass as well as other Bluegrass Heart material. And then there's an incredible clarinetist named Annette Cohen, who's going to come out, who I've wanted to do something with. So she's kind of a wild card, and we'll do some duos. And we'll see if we can't get her up on stage with a Bluegrass Heart Band, too.
That would be great. For some reason, I know who she is, and I can't tell you why. But I know that I've heard her name,
yeah,
and maybe seen some bits of her, heard some bits of her music, and I'd have no idea what in connection
well,
to.
Well, she's like, in Billboard, in Downbeat Magazine, which is the jazz periodical. Everybody, all the people that just are really into the details of jazz love that magazine, and it's for them. And she always wins the Regis Poll as the best clarinet player.
That could be.
And she's of the younger generation. There's also wonderful clarinet players, other ones that are so good. But she's of this generation, and she's from Israel, and she's got her own beautiful way of playing. And so anyway, I've always wanted to do something with her. And you might have heard, I think she sat in on a track of Alison Brown's last record.
That's exactly what it was. Yes, and I was impressed then. So the other things too, plus that, and I'm thinking, wow,
yeah,
what a great, okay, very good.
There was a lot of stuff going on that show.
Yeah.
And that show's starting to sell quite well, so I think, of course, people, I don't expect people to buy a plane flight in a hotel and go, but if you are, you should get on it.
I think so. There's I looked at it this morning just because I'm always curious about availability, and there's some seats available, but like Bayless saying, this is, we're talking about May 4th, so it's coming up quickly, and it's like all the good stuff we're talking about and plus some more things. Here's what I want to touch with you quickly. And I'm mindful of your time here, Baylen. I always appreciate your time. But I've read through the notes on the Rhapsody in Blue and your connection with George Gershwin, how it started you were very young and you were exposed, and all that great story about being in New York and being exposed to that. And here's my question. It's a great story. Question, though, is, so you've performed with symphony orchestras on things that you've composed.
Right.
And you've recorded those, and we've talked about those here on Unreal Bluegrass. It's just wonderful stuff. But as I listen to Rhapsody in Blue, and then also the Rhapsody in Bluegrass, there is, in the symphonic music that you've written and performed with, it differs in my mind from Gershwin, from the Rhapsody in Blue, because all of a sudden the changes in volume, or let's say frequency, or the sound, is real dramatic. I mean, it goes from tiny to gigantic sounds in the Gershwin stuff, all of a sudden.
Right.
And so you're there with a banjo. So what I want to know is, on stage, how do you deal with those big swings? I mean, they're from tiny little bits to the huge band kick.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that as a performer?
Well, I mean, I always think that's a cool thing in a concerto. A concerto, I'm going to make this simple for anybody who's bluegrass music or just doesn't know what it is usually a soloist in front of an orchestra. It's always the man against machine or man against giant, or this epic thing where there's one little person playing and then the whole orchestra comes in.
Yeah.
And that's the nature of a concerto. That's kind of the problem for any concerto. Now, if you play piano, it's loud enough that you don't have too much trouble. But even on this concerto, which it, of course, was written by George Gershwin, it was his first concerto, and he didn't know what he was doing any more than I knew what I was doing, in that he was well along in his musical growth, but he'd never written one before. And I didn't know what I was doing when I was writing The Impostor, and maybe I knew a little bit more when I was writing Juno, the second concerto.
Yeah.
But, I mean, he chose to, this was also possibly because he wrote it in 3 weeks, he chose to have a lot of solo music. So, yes, the orchestra gets real big and it swallows up the piano, but then they stop.
Yeah.
And then, what I didn't realize until I started playing it with the orchestra, I was practicing and practicing, I didn't quite realize that I was going to be by myself for an enormous part of this piece. So it was kind of all down to me. The other thing that's been really wonderful, I have to say, is, so when I do my own concertos, there's a huge learning curve. It sounds like crap when we start, no matter who I'm playing it with, because they've never played it before, and it's not harder than lots and lots of classical music. It's just they don't know it. The classical music, they know it. They've heard it since they were children. So when they play a very difficult piece, generally, unless it's new music, generally it's in their blood, it's in their bones.
Yeah.
So what I've been loving about playing Rhapsody is they know it. So we get out and we rehearse it once or twice, and they don't really even need to. All we need to do is iron out two or three little things, And they just bring it. They can just bring it with their full selves without concern and fear, the fear that they have on my piece, which is full of, you know, traps and problems and things that someone that doesn't, I mean, I would say somebody who hasn't had a lot of experience writing concertos would write or understands classical music the way a great composer would. But I have to say, neither did George Gershwin, but look what he came up with. That's so, you know, sometimes it's humbling, but of course people have had a long time to learn that piece and have played it countless times. So there is a joy to playing. It's like playing, you know, Foggy Mountain Breakdown or playing Sunset Road with the Flecktones or playing, you know, Whitewater with Sam Bush. It feels like you're playing something nobody's worrying about it. It's just playing.
That's a
we
great
just
point.
Play.
Oh, that's a great point. Yeah, you're right. So from their point of view, once they look at they're reading fly specs, which they do all the time, and they do little changes, and they're right there and ready to stomp mm-hmm. on it. And you're the person getting swallowed up because you're the position of George.
Right, but also I am mic'd. I put a microphone on. We just try to make it blend into the orchestra and not feel like it's coming from way overhead. So usually we put little speakers closer okay. to me so that it's the sound is it feels like it's coming from the orchestra as if I were louder rather than a big P, because usually the orchestra is not amplified, but I am, just like a classical guitar concerto would be. You wouldn't hear them.
Right. It's
so that's that.
Works mm-hmm. great. It works great. I loved your analogy with George learning it and doing it quickly. And if anybody gets they should have the CD or the album and read the liner notes. It explains a lot of these things that Bela is referring to. That George Gershwin's. I don't know him that well. George Gershwin's first concerto, boom mm-hmm. as it is, and then your efforts to reproduce that and make it something that you can play as you've done now and record it. And I also remember when you. Because in the notes it talks about all of a sudden I'm in Nashville in front of a symphony. I remember
right.
when you appeared down there, and I thought, well, that was really kind of quick because I kind of knew something was going on, and I thought, wow, that's pretty nice. You must have really you sped up the process, I guess, and worked it out with the Nashville Symphony, and that was a while ago.
Well, they're the ones that instigated me actually doing it because I mentioned it to the CEO, it's funny, I feel like I'm a big-time musician now. Like, I know the CEO of the Nashville Symphony, but I know him because I got to do a banjo concerto with him, and every once in a while he asked me for a favor, like, hey, could you sign one of your albums? We're gonna at rock auction it off, and we're trying to raise money, which symphonies always need to do. So he got in touch with me for something like that. And I said, hey, Alan, you're going to think this is ridiculous, but I've been messing with the Rhapsody in Blue. And I think it's actually possible to play the whole piano part on the banjo. And I'm learning it as a thought experiment here during the pandemic. And he said, great, we'll put it on the show. We'll make it the first show of the season for the big gala. Well, okay. I was like, okay. And then all of a sudden, this idea I was messing with became like, wow, not only do I have to do it, but I have to do it by... you know, in 5 months, basically, or 5 or 6 months. So, and then that led me to becoming much more practical about figuring out how to play something that I was really going to be able to play in front of people, not just something that was so complicated I could do it in pieces in the studio or something. So that, I know we want to talk about some other stuff, but that's part of the story.
No.
It's kind of fun.
It's a great story.
Yeah, but then once I knew I was going to perform it, like with the Nashville Symphony, and I was going to be rehearsing my butt off, to get it ready, I was, well, like, I might as well record it. And then I realized it was the 100th anniversary of the piece. And I said, well, if I'm going to record it, I better record it so it comes out by then, because what a thing to miss.
Sure, yeah.
If you're doing it anyway. So that's what happened. And then everything else came after that. Well, what goes with this 18-minute piece? That's not enough for a record.
No.
And the Rhapsody in Bluegrass idea crept into my brain. And I tried to swat it away, but it kept coming back because it seemed like a really cheesy thing to do. But then I think maybe there's a way to do this that's really cool.
Why would it be cheesy? I don't get that part of it. I mean,
I don't know. You know, I don't love on an odd moment, I don't mind somebody doing like a bluegrass version of something.
Yeah.
But generally, I find it to be, I don't know, it's kind of light and silly. That piece, I love the piece so much, I didn't want to do something trite with it.
Yeah.
You know, on occasion I love to do a cover of some, you know, Beatles song or whatever, you know, with the house band and with Sam Bush or Flecktones or whatever, but just as an odd thing. But this seemed like such a big, important work to me. I didn't want to do something that made fun of it or like hee-haw, you know, this is not a hee-haw thing for me. So I wanted to do a bluegrass version that had a lot of depth and interest and was as good as like a great Tony Rice record or, you know, or Strength in Numbers, or something that had that kind of, emotional resonance as well. So, anyway, I feel really proud of what we came up with because I smile when I listen to it, but I also am not laughing at it. And I'm not laughing at the original piece.
And if you just tune in, I'm talking to, we've talked to Bela Fleck about several things he's got going on, and including the most recent release, which is Rhapsody in Blue. But because of Bluegrass Heart, you had a core of people that were used to switching in and switching out and performing with you, and I think you pulled in some of those people.
It was the team that's been out on tour the most, Michael Cleveland and Brian Sutton, Mark Schatz, Justin Moses, Sierra Hull. And those guys were frankly getting, I don't want to say bored, because my music's pretty hard, but they, you know, there was a part, you know, they had it down. Yeah. And it was like time for something, or I was going to lose their focus. And I know this with bands, as a band leader among equals, among strong musicians usually, almost always. And it's that they need to be challenged. And when we're working on something and figuring something out, pushing, that they're at their best. And then once they know it, they kind of start to drift and be on their phones and thinking about the next thing. So, you know, when you're in a band and you want it to be vital, you need to be working on something. So this seemed like a great thing, not only to give us a new release for that group, and so we could go forward and do some more fun stuff, but just to keep everybody engaged.
Yeah, okay, that makes
sense. So it worked that way, too.
Yeah, mm-hmm. you had a trained troupe with you, and I want to switch gears here. I'm going to try to speed things up. I know your time constraints, but I do want to speak just about As We Speak, the album that was released last year and won a Grammy.
Yeah.
And I've played cuts of it on Unreal Bluegrass because that's just how I do things. But So here's my question, though, is what was your introduction to, I'll say Indian because I don't really know what to call it. I don't know that. I don't mean that to be like an overclassification. Yeah. But so where did you first start hearing it? I know my exposure to it.
I can tell you. Do you want to tell me yours first?
Well, mine was first through the Bengals, the Beatles, and then then Bangladesh concert where Ravi appears by himself, and then you start thinking there's really something. And then on top of that was John McLaughlin when he did Shakti.
Right.
Yeah.
So all those same things for me were my initial thing and Shakti, but the thing that really lit it up for me. And because Sam Bush was always a big Shakti fan. And for people who don't know Shakti, it was John McLaughlin, one of the greatest jazz rock guitar players of all time. And this incredible tabla player, Zakir Hussain, who is the son of the tabla player who played with Ravi Shankar all those years, Alaraka.
Oh, okay.
So I got to go to India with Newgrass Revival on a cultural exchange program called USIS back in the mid-1980s, and when we were in India, I found my way. Every country we were in, I went and found the musicians and set up, you know, lessons or jams or whatever I could get the embassy to help me do. And that's where I started, you know, really getting – I took a few Indian lessons from teachers who gave me sort of the rudiments of what was going on. I bought some tabla rudiment books. I bought records, CDs. We all did. And I came home just sort of really excited about that music. And then from then on, I would, you know, if in Nashville, for instance, we have a temple where they have Indian performances once in a while, and people come over, and in a lot of places they have those performances. You just have to know they're happening, and I saw some great music and continued to love it. And then I got to start running into Zakir Hussain when I started being on the jazz circuit with the Flecktones.
Yeah.
And it just grew from that.
That makes sense. Yeah, that makes sense. You recently did perform with the Shakti, I think. Was it up in Columbus, Ohio?
I did that. That was their farewell tour, and I got to open the show, 10 of the shows around the country, in pretty big venues. And it was solo banjo, so it was a lot of fun playing for, you know, 5,000-6,000 people sometimes, just walk out and play 45 minutes of solo stuff. But it was also great to watch those guys because they were fabulous. And John had, there had been rumors that he, wasn't able to play. He'd even retired once, and then he had some work done that helped his hands, his arthritis, and he was able to play quite close to his original ability. And so he said, I'll go out again. And so they did this farewell tour. And I hope he keeps playing because he's feeling better and playing quite well.
I hope
he is in his 80s now.
No,
yeah.
And I think
the tour was amazing. It was absolutely great.
I couldn't go to Columbus. My closest opportunities, I wasn't able to go. But I will say this about John McLaughlin, and we'll get back to some other things. But I don't think there's been a more creative, dynamic, exploratory guitar player ever. I mean, he's done everything. He came out of that fusion era, which is where I got attached to Chick, and Chick Corea, we'll talk about in a minute. And he's done straight jazz, which is phenomenal. He's done the Shakti stuff. He's done Mahavishnu Orchestra, which is like, I don't even know. I mean, but all that stuff. And he's always just an amazing person right at the front. So I'm glad. I hope he feels better and he keeps playing. Maybe I can
He seems to be doing great. And there's a few people like that who are very inspiring to me in my little bluegrass banjo community and world. Pat Metheny, Chick Corea, John McLaughlin, Herbie Hancock, and I can come up with a few more, but not that many that kind of just keep on creating and creating and creating, and they don't get worse. They don't get worse. They keep on growing and finding different ways to be themselves and find unity with other kinds of musicians. So that's kind of the template of my career.
I get all three of those, and Pat Metheny, every time I see him, it's a different deal. It's a whole different thing that he's doing. It's like, well, this is his big fusion band, he called it, and then he did stuff solo. I've seen him half a dozen times, thanks to our friend Howard up in Miami. He used to bring you to the Hamilton campus up in Ohio all the time, and I saw you there every time. And then he would bring in Pat, too. That's just the way you get to see all those great things. Let me real quickly switch to... I hope I'm
keeping it moving.
I don't want to run out of time. So I also know that coming out in May 10th of this year, we talked a little bit about Chick, but there's a new release. It's called Remembrance, and there's 14 cuts, and I've been listening to it for at least a day. And I love this thing with Chick Corea. I was a big fan of Chick Corea and yours, and I know that you did a couple things together. One was a live Two, that was one of my favorites. And then the Enchantment, in your connection with Chick goes back, and I look at you both as a similar type artist, in that it's a very exploratory and brave, you know, go where you can go and make it work. But so this new album that's being released of old recordings, I do want to touch on that just a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So Chick was one of my fundamental heroes. When I was 17, I heard him play live, and it transformed my entire point of view about music, and I'd say directly led to my desire to create something like the Flecktones. Some combination of seeing him and the idea of the David Grisman Quintet seemed to me it led towards some way that the banjo could lead a jazz-oriented group, but that also was very diverse and that was full of equals and virtuosos that all had their own point of view, which was what was so great about Chick's bands. He always had the best players, and he let them have a lot of room, which he learned from Miles Davis. Get somebody great and don't chain them.
That's right.
Let them go. Let them bring their thing. Try and find a way to show each person off. And then it only makes you more interesting. You can't be threatened by having great people around you. You have to rise to it, to their level sometimes. And you have to take care of yourself in the group too. But with instrumental music, a band where there's one guy up front playing all the time, for me, becomes boring. I want to hear other soloists. I want to hear him interacting, or he or she interacting with the other musicians in the group. You know, I'm not looking for a solo. I mean, it can be great. Anything can be great if it's great. But I like the idea, and it's also more fun because you're playing with people. You're having a real experience. You're not like, okay, here I am doing my thing, and got to get the band to play it exactly this way. I'm not into that. I want life and motion and excitement, and I want to be charged up by the people I'm playing with.
Well, and maybe that's why you and Chick were such a great pairing. I mean, everything you did. And I saw Chick one time solo, which was mind-blowing. He was touring with Gary Burton, but Gary couldn't make this leg. And so it's Chick on stage with a piano for a couple hours, and I'm thinking, this is the most incredible thing I've ever seen.
You never get bored.
No.
Did he do the thing where he got somebody up on stage and played them?
No, I've heard of him doing that, but he didn't do that. He had a bunch of compositions in his bench that he did when he was like six or seven, and he would get those out.
He's the kind of guy who can just pull out a sheet of paper, one sheet of paper, and play for 20 minutes on that idea.
That's right.
Which I do in certain idioms and certain languages, but not like that. So, it was the stunning and amazing. I still can't believe that I got to be friends and got to play with him. I played with him once. He played on a record for me. I thought, okay, that's it. I got it. I'm not going to bother him again. But then he got in touch with me, and it was like, he was like, hey, you want to try some duo stuff and see what happens? And I just won the lottery. And I got to spend a lot of time with him over about 15 years, I'm thinking. I don't have the exact dates, but we went out over and over again as a duo in these big concert halls, and basically it was incredibly inspiring, but also petrifying, because where he could go where I couldn't, and I was just afraid of being embarrassed and shaming the banjo community, because it was like an unusual opportunity to play with one of the top jazz musicians of the day in a duo concert over and over and over again. But as time went on, you know, I got used to it. And so this album is after that. And in fact, we were playing the same material for so many years. And for him, he was, you know, one week he was doing this, the next week he was doing that. So he would do the material that group did. He wouldn't show up and say, hey, here's five new songs. And maybe he was doing it for me, because he could tell I was getting better and better and at hanging with him. But near the end, I was like, hey, Chick, let's do some different stuff. And he said, I said, I'm going to bring three new tunes. And he said, okay, well, then I'll bring some tunes. And because up till then, I had brought tunes out on tour and put it in front of him. And he'd go, yeah, that's nice, but let's just play the stuff. I'm busy getting ready for this concerto, or I'm writing. So this tour, we played 9 or 10 songs we'd never played before, and we did the whole tour. And at the end of the tour, I said, hey, Chick, I'll come down to Florida anytime, we can lay these down. He said, we just did, dude. And because his engineer had been multi-tracking everything.
Oh, okay.
He said, and you're the producer, and so go listen to him and tell me what we got. And I was like, oh no, because, you know, I'm gonna suck and he's gonna be great. And so it took me till the middle of the pandemic till I got the nerve to like start pulling these things up and going through the shows. And sure enough, you know, somewhere throughout all those shows, we got each song fabulous. There was a great night where we hit each song somewhere. So I started sending it to him, and he started, you know, signing off on this version or that version. And then he said, hey, I'm going to send you a tune I'm working on. You play on it and send it back to me. And we started doing that during the pandemic. So he sent me a nice complicated tune. I think it was called, we called it his Latin tune. So for the album, it's called Latin Tune Backwards. But,
oh, but he liked to do that kind of wordplay. I was just going to ask you. That's one of my favorite tunes. And I kept thinking, how do I say this when I ask? How do I pronounce it? Oh, bad boy.
It's like on the first album, he had a tune called Dad Nod Nopia. And I never knew what it was. And so one day I said, you know, what is that? He said, you can't figure it out. I said, no, he said, it's a jumble. It's just banjo and piano with the letters jumbled. I was like, oh, man, like for years I've been wondering what it was, but I wasn't going to ask. So so in this case, I just thought, now he's gone. He passed away, so I've got to name the tune. Yeah. So I thought, well, he would maybe like
he
that.
Cause
it's
okay.
But anyway, I play on the thing, send it back to him. He says, great, that's one. Now you write a tune, lay down your part and send it to me, and I'll play on it. So, and, you know, it wasn't like you send it to him and you say, oh, could you change this, this, and this? It's Chick Corea. So I was nervously awaiting him to send me back this thing going, God, what if I don't like it? Or what if, you know, because, you know, sometimes people work fast, sometimes people work slow, sometimes people toss things off, sometimes people do detail work. You never know. So he sends me the thing very, very fast. And I'm like, okay, here we go. And I listen to it. I'm like, yes, this is awesome. I love what he did. So then it was back and forth. So, you know, so that's what all the album has consisted of, is these brand new tunes that we did on tour that you know, are new to us. There's a couple covers of Monk cover and a Scarlatti piece that we would do on tour that was really special. And then these new tunes, and then I said, hey, Chick, I always love it when you do these improvs at the beginning of the songs.
Yeah,
and I wish I could play along, because they're so good. They're probably like a lot of what you saw him do that night when he played solo. It's just like he just starts playing and says, like, oh, I wish I could get in on that. So I said, could you just send me some short improvs, you know, 2 or 3 minutes long, and then I'll figure out a way to play along. And so the next day, boom, 5 short improvs, you know.
This is so. I'm running you up against the wall, Baylor, but I want to thank you again. We're talking about now. We moved on to talk about Remembrance, which is this thing that'll be out on. I've already ordered it, and I've hit.
Well, awesome. We can finish this bit of the conversation. I know you're trying to get me out on time for my next interview, but a couple minutes grace is okay. So at any rate, we created these pieces that were 5 short interludes that I really love them, because they're just so different, and they're not tunes in a conventional sense. They're almost like classical etudes. They're not etudes. They're not exercises. They're just very fluid, unique pieces of music. So thank goodness we got to a whole new chapter and before the sad the loss of the great Chick Corea.
He was, boy, phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I happen to have Stars by Ones, if we had time, which we don't, but I had Star by what I now know is Latin tune backwards, and I was trying to pronounce Inuit Natal. But anyway, so that's the third one.
Well, he would have loved making everybody mispronounce it.
Well, I did. I was doing the Google thing. How do you pronounce Inuit? How do you pronounce it? So I still didn't quite. So I had a Star by that. I love the Bemsha Swing. I've got and I will do this as we're leaving Bela. Juno also had a Star by it. I really like that tune. I like all of them, but I was thinking if there were three of them that I had to really focus on. So what I would like to do, Bela, is thank you again for your time and all your music and all the fun stuff that you're making available for banjo players. And
my pleasure. I got to tell you one quick story. I'm going to do it in a minute because for various reasons. But Juno was written. Within a few hours of my son Juno being born, and I missed the birth because he came 3 weeks early, and I got permission from the doctor to do these solo gigs in California, and I was catching the red eye home, and he was born during my set with the phone on a chair next to me.
Oh, no kidding.
So I got on the plane, and I headed home, and I was really bummed out because I'd missed the birth, and I couldn't get out by the time I found out she was going into labor because there's a certain time of day if you're on the West Coast that you just can't get home. You know, there's no flights at that time till the red eyes. So I was stuck. So I did the gig, and in fact, Zakir came out and played Happy Birthday. But anyway, I'm on my layover in Dallas, and I'm sitting there going, "Now I'm coming home empty-handed, and I missed the birth." And I got out my banjo and I wrote that tune right then and there, and we on the layover, and then got on the flight to Nashville and went to meet Juno. So that's the story of Juno, and it turned out to be a very playful, fun tune.
I like the chick
really loved to play it.
I like it, and not because it's your son's name. I just thought these are tunes. Let's not look at the names, and some of them I can't pronounce. But anyway, so I love this. So that's great. Bela, go about your business. I know you're a busy guy, and I'll catch you somewhere down the road, okay? And
we're gonna, all right, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, as I say goodbye to you, I'm going to play Juno from that album we just talked about in the audience.
All right, Steve.
Take care of yourself, man.
Appreciate it a lot.
See you, bye.
Thanks. Bye.